show. Along the way, I've learned about local artists and their music, and other artists and music I never would have heard of or listened to before. I'm still here, still doing shows, still having fun. If what I do sounds like something you'd enjoy, visit us on the second floor of the University Center and find out what CFRU has to offer you.
The Guelph Wellington Sex Workers Action Group engages community organizations, public agencies, and individuals with lived experience in a collaborative effort to improve the systems and conditions that marginalize sex workers in Guelph and Wellington County. SWAG works in solidarity with individuals working in sex work towards our vision of a healthier, safer, respected, and better world. Also, please join us Thursday, December 17th between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. in St. George's Square for our event in support of International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. You can find us by the red umbrellas, ready to greet you with smiles, resources, and swag bags. For more information or to learn how to become involved, check us out on Facebook under Sex Workers Action Group Guelph or contact Sarah Wilmer, Women Community Development Coordinator at 519-763-2255 extension 161. Sex Workers Action Group looks forward to collaborating with you.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Hombres y mujeres de las villas, campesinos y obreros, y mujeres, adelante estudiantes, adelante villaregos, vivan las villas, viva la patria, viva el maestro Martí Conrado Rodríguez, viva la alfabetización, viva la cultura, viva el trabajo.
Conocer a Martí y a Fidel,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
Si quiere conocer los caminos del Che,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
Si quiere tomar ron pero sin Coca-Cola,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
Si quiere trabajar en la caña de azúcar,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
En un barquito se va al vaivén,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
Si quiere conocer a Martí y a Fidel,
a Cuba, y a Cuba iré.
Yo no toco el son, pero
toco la guitarra, que está justo en la batalla de nuestra revolución. Será lo mismo que el son que hizo bailar los gringos, pero no somos guajiros, nuestra sierra es la elección. Si quieres conocer a Martí y a Fidel,
a Cuba, a Cuba y a Cuba iré.
Si quieres conocer los caminos del Che,
a Cuba, a Cuba y a Cuba iré.
Si quieres tomar ron pero sin Coca-Cola,
a Cuba, a Cuba y a Cuba iré.
Si quieres trabajar en la caña de azúcar,
a Cuba, a Cuba y a Cuba iré.
En un barquito se va el vaivén,
a Cuba, a Cuba y a Cuba iré.
Si quieres conocer a Martí y a Fidel,
a Cuba, a Cuba y a Cuba iré.
Si quieres conocer los caminos del Che,
a Cuba, a Cuba y a Cuba iré.
Si quieres tomar ron pero sin Coca-Cola,
a Cuba, a Cuba y a Cuba iré.
Si quieres trabajar en la caña de azúcar.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and welcome to 2016, brothers and sisters. It's good to have you with us. And just to prove that everything, that things can change on a New Year's Day, I'm going to talk a little bit about here tonight about some of the revolutionary changes that actually have taken place on New Year's Days in the past. And of course, we have two very, very significant dates, which don't get, one of which in particular doesn't get talked about nearly as much as it deserves. I'm going to start with the Haitian Revolution. Now, the Haitian Revolution, the victory of the Haitian Revolution took place on January 1st, 1804. The anti-colonial struggles that swept Latin America and most notably Haiti, you know, were very significant early anti-colonial struggles that really laid the groundwork for many national liberation movements that came after them. And in many ways showed the limitations of the bourgeois revolutionary struggle, you could say, which took place in the 18th and early 19th centuries, in terms of how far they went. But in Haiti, where Toussaint Louverture and Jean-Jacques Dessalines, the leaders of the revolution by black slaves, which not only toppled French colonial rule, but also established a sovereign republic, which they successfully defended, not only against Napoleon's attempts at reconquest, but military interventions by both Britain and Spain. This revolution was directly inspired by, they were directly inspired by their French counterparts, and they clearly revealed the limitations of the European bourgeois class revolution by revolting against a colonial slavocracy that the French revolutionaries had failed to abolish. You know, and of course, Haiti also proved a very strong base for Simon Bolivar and the various Latin American revolutionaries who went on to liberate Latin America from Spanish rule. So this was a very, very crucial thing. And this is like, and this, of course, is the first really significant cracks really started to emerge in the slavocracy in the West around this time, when it was made very clear that African slaves could liberate themselves and actually bring themselves to self-government, to self-rule, and control their own affairs and exercise self-determination in this way and overthrow the slavocracy ruling over them. It basically sent shockwaves through the Americas in particular, particularly to the United States, like to the Americas, which of course worked very, very hard to contain the Cuban Revolution and to make sure it didn't spread and to make sure, and of course, America's intervened in Haiti, you know, many, many, many times militarily in order to suppress the movements that were, you know, set in motion by the Haitian Revolution. So that is very, very important to remember. We don't see the kind of discussion, you know, around the Haitian Revolution that we even see around the Cuban Revolution, which I'm going to talk about in just a few minutes. But Haiti, of course, remains a colony. You know, to this day, the so-called international community, UN peacekeepers, well, you know, they're called UN peacekeepers, but of course what they are is an occupying army, is in there basically protecting the interests of sweatshop owners and multinational corporations, and including Canadian mining multinational corporations, which are in Haiti right now more or less controlling the people, controlling the labor force, controlling the resources. And the Cubans do not have, the Haitians, I should say, do not have self-determination. They do not. The Cubans do have self-determination. If you want to compare Cuba, the living standards in Cuba, and the level of control that the Cuban people have over their own affairs, like, you know, their economy, their social life, their culture, and you compare that with Haiti, I mean, it's just, it's black and white. You know, the contrast there is just incredible. You know, and the fight goes on, really, for Haitian self-determination. Like, to this day, I mean, the Haitian people have been, there's been riots last November during a very much rigged presidential election. You know, the Cuban, the Haitian people, I should say, are not taking this lying down. And, but of course, there has been a lot of solidarity between the Cuban people and the Haitian people. I mean, the Cuban doctors are in Haiti. Certainly, Cuban people are trying to support the Haitian struggle in any way they can. But it is very, very hard. You know, it's the most impoverished nation in the Western Hemisphere. You know, it's been, and it's, it is that way because it's been beaten down so many times by imperialism. But once again, they blazed a path. They showed that what can be done, and what can be done when the people exercise their power and overthrow imperialism and imperial control. Haiti showed what can be done, and it can show that again. But on January 1st, 1959, we also have the example of the Cuban Revolution. Fidel Castro toppled an American puppet dictatorship in Cuba. You know, and Fidel Castro and the movement that he led, they toppled the Batista dictatorship and proceeded to defend Cuba and its people against decades of retaliation from a global superpower that stood barely 90 miles away. And despite facing invasion, sabotage, terrorism, and a crippling economic blockade, Cuba would produce a vibrant socialist economy with one of the highest living standards in the Third World. You know, and even today, this vibrancy is plain to see. You know, they even call it like a, you know, there's been articles written on in Telesur recently about Cuba's socialist spirit level. You know, the spirit of socialist Cuba, their defiant spirit in terms of keeping socialism alive and keeping it going in the face of, you know, the most incredible difficulties imaginable. Now, in Cuba, healthcare is provided free for everyone. Illiteracy has been eliminated. Multinational corporations and cartels have been expelled. And the means of production have been placed under popular control and have been so for decades. Now, working in solidarity with the Soviet Union and other socialist countries, Cuba not only survived in the face of the blockade, in the face of all manner of sabotage, they don't only survived, but thrived, and has played an unparalleled internationalist role in solidarity with other third world nations in struggle. Cuban soldiers would play a key role in the defeat of apartheid South Africa, the liberation of Namibia, and in the defense of the Angolan and Ethiopian revolutions against CIA-backed reactionary forces. The defeat of the South African army at the Battle of Cuito Coneval in June 1988 would effectively mark the beginning of the end for the apartheid regime in South Africa. As the sole bastion of socialist revolution in the Western Hemisphere, the Cuban Revolution would even endure the collapse of the Soviet Union and survive against immense odds, to inspire new generations of radicals throughout the world with the knowledge of what can be done. You know, and of course we see the example of Cuba's socialist medical system, and how it not only provides state-of-the-art care for its own citizens, but exports medical care throughout the world. In true international spirit, Cuban doctors can be found saving lives everywhere from Pakistan to West Africa, you know, where they've played a major role in combating the Ebola epidemic. In fact, they're virtually the only, where of course the United States sent Marines and soldiers and, you know, thousands of them, supposedly to reinforce security in these countries. The Cubans actually sent doctors and serious medical aid, which actually helped save the lives of thousands and thousands of people. You know, this is the kind of internationalism, you know, that the Cuba engages in. This is what it does around the world. This is how it shows its true face. You know, and of course it's played a very pivotal role in helping the various socialist movements that have swept to power in various areas around Latin America recently. We have in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, you know, all these places, in Nicaragua. You know, it's provided support to them, it's provided medical assistance to them, it's provided A forum for them. You know, there's been a very strong working economic relations between the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela with the Cuban Revolution, and this is a beautiful thing to see, this kind of international solidarity that exists, and like how Cuba has endured in the face of all of this, and like developed, you know, institutions of popular empowerment, like, you know, where the Cuban citizens can participate directly in their communities, directly in political affairs, and where they have right of recall over their own representatives in the National Assembly, and these kind of things, which, you know, Canadian citizens don't have. These rights that Canadian citizens don't have, and most citizens in the Western countries don't have. But I want to read this article about, of course, I've talked about a lot about why, about Cuban internationalism and Cuban, particularly with regard to medicine and medical aid. And this article is entitled, Why Cuba is So Good at Fighting Ebola. This appeared actually in Time magazine, believe it or not. So Florian Plateau, the first, I began at the wrong place, sorry about that. As the first nation to dedicate hundreds of healthcare workers to West Africa, Cuba is an unlikely hero in the Ebola outbreak. In spite of not being among the wealthiest countries, Cuba is one of the most committed when it comes to deploying doctors to crisis zones. It has offered more than 460 Cuban doctors and nurses to West Africa, and currently 165 are working there under the direction of the World Health Organization. More than 50,000 healthcare workers from Cuba are working in 66 countries around the world. Cuba is world famous for its ability to train outstanding doctors and nurses, said WHO Director Margaret Chan in a September press conference announcing Cuba's surge of healthcare workers. In the same meeting, Cuban Minister of Health Roberto Morales Ojeda called on all countries to join the struggle against this disease. But why is Cuba so uniquely prepared to treat Ebola? It comes down to a national priority that even has its own name, coined by academics, Cuban medical internationalism. Cuba's global health crisis response system is a Doctors Without Borders-like program, but instituted by the government. When Cuban doctors graduate medical school, they are given the opportunity to volunteer to be called for medical missions, like an Ebola outbreak or a natural catastrophe. Often these are 1 to 2 year commitments. To prepare for something like Ebola, healthcare workers not only undergo aggressive training for the specific disease they are treating, but they also take courses on the region's culture and history as well. And quote, this is something built into the psyche of Cuban doctors and nurses, the idea that I am a public servant, said Gail Reed, co-founder of Medical Education Cooperation with Cuba. It's coming from a commitment to make healthcare a universally accepted right. It started around 1960, shortly after the Cuban Revolution. A massive earthquake killed up to 5,000 people in Chile, and Cuba sent healthcare workers into the disaster aftermath. A few years later, a medical team of more than 50 people went into war-torn Algeria. In 1998, two major hurricanes, George and Mitch, ravaged Latin America and the Caribbean, once again, Cuba went in. Even during Hurricane Katrina, a team of Cuban doctors trained to go to the U.S., but President Bush said it wasn't necessary. In 1998, Cuban medical teams discovered that they were treating a lot of people who had never before had access to doctors. And they decided that leaving the healthcare systems as they found them was irresponsible. So Cuba founded the Latin American Medical School, which offers scholarships to low-income students from around the world with the expectation that they will graduate and return to their home countries as health workers. There are not many schools founded on the belief that poor people can become doctors and serve the community and be part of the solution, says Reed. More than 23,000 physicians from low-income communities in 83 countries, even the U.S., have graduated from ELAM, and nearly 10,000 are currently enrolled. Not surprisingly, Cuba's leadership in the current Ebola epidemic has become political in the U.S. Republicans are angry that a CDC worker recently went to Cuba for an Ebola meeting. And many argue that Cuba's motivations aren't purely altruistic. Some countries pay Cuba for their services, though price tags differ by country. Others argue that Cuba's deep reverence for solidarity amongst the marginalized is the real motivator, and that working in countries that don't provide adequate care to their own citizens is a political statement. Besides payment, Cuba also gains international goodwill and cooperation between countries. The very fact that Cuba is the only other nation than the United States to contribute human resources to the Ebola crisis in a big way creates enormous international political capital, especially when most nations are unwilling to send their own people into the center of the calamity, says Robert Huish, a professor of international development studies at Dalhousie University in Canada. On October 17th, Fidel Castro wrote an op-ed in the country's state-run newspaper arguing that the U.S. and Cuba should work together on Ebola, if only for better coordination. "We will happily cooperate with U.S. personnel on this task, not in search of peace between these two states, which have been adversaries for so many years, but rather, in any event, for world peace, an objective which can and should be attempted," Castro wrote. "At the very least, the Cuban model has a message for the international community, that local people can work for the greater health of their homelands, and that constant preparation is more sustainable than being caught off guard. Cuba's lesson for us is that health, and global health in particular, needs to be addressed with proactive, forward-looking commitment to strengthening health systems, not just by reacting to disaster. Aid groups like the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders have been calling for more physical boots on the ground, and so far Cuba has been the only country well-poised to answer that call." So that's Cuban medical internationalism in Africa and around the world, and it's a shining example for the world and really for what socialism can do. And of course, like what socialism has done in Cuba is absolutely amazing in terms of its ability to, you know, raise living standards and develop human potential and develop like and eliminate illiteracy and eliminate diseases and just, you know, eliminate the legacy of underdevelopment in that country, which of course was imposed first by Spain and then of course by the United States and the various puppet dictatorships that ruled in Cuba up until 1959 and the revolution, which took place on New Year's Day. So it's a very, very pivotal moment, the Cuban Revolution, and something that, you know, should definitely be celebrated around the world. And so what I want to play now is I want to play a clip from the Communist Party of Great Britain Marxist-Leninist. This is, they brought somebody from the Cuban embassy who spoke for about 10 minutes about Cuba, about Cuban solidarity with various revolutionary movements in Africa, and about really the significance of the Cuban Revolution and how it relates to the broader revolutionary movement around the world. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Our next speaker is representative of a tiny country which has done no harm to anybody but has done a lot of harm and given tremendous revolutionary fraternal support to people fighting for their liberation, for their health, for their education, for their eyesight and everything. And I refer here to the heroic Socialist Republic of Cuba, which has for 60 years held aloft the banner of Marxism-Leninism and of national liberation in Latin America. Cuba and its leadership is a living example of the fact that small people, provided they're determined and provided they have the support of their own populations, can defeat the mightiest imperialist power. After 5 decades of blockade and having no diplomatic relations with Cuba, the mighty United States has been forced to open its embassy in Cuba and allow the Cuban flag to fly from the American soil and have diplomatic representatives of each other exchanged, and are now beginning to emerge. Not quite, because the blockade is still there. For the moment, we only have diplomatic relations. The US Congress has to put an end to the blockade. Now, it's really trying to find out the difference between Hitler and Himmler. You don't know whether it's White House that is more reactionary or the Congress. And between the two of them, they make a pretty good potent mix. And so let's hope that the common sense and pressure from the American people, among pressure from elsewhere, would force the U.S. Congress to do away the blockade that has tried to strangle Cuba. Cuba cannot be strangled anymore. And in this context, I'm very pleased to call Comrade José Luis Castro.
First of all, allow me to thank Conrad Harper for those words that encourage our Cuban people. And thanks the party for the support that has been given to Cuban people and to our struggle for so many years, like support for the freedom of the Cuban Five, who finally returned to last December to our homeland because of, in a way, the solidarity moving of the, all over the world, and in particular here, and the support of the party like the Communist Britain Party, Marxist-Leninism. I also want to take the opportunity to give an upgrade of current situation about my country, because as Conrad Harper said, the blockade is still in full implementation. Even that the Western media has spread the idea that everything is over. But it's not. So we are continuing their fighting and saying and showing that the morality of the blockade is still damages our people. And we are recently in 27th of October, for 24 occasions, it was passed a United Nations resolution against the blockade. It was almost unanimous because 195 countries voted supporting the resolution against the blockade. Just U.S. and Israel were in favor. We are doing this because we need to defeat the blockade in order to keep our revolution. Keep our revolution is a way to feeding the spirit of the October Revolution. So it's a way. And we as working people, as part of the government that rules a country of working people, we have to continue feeding the spirit of the October Revolution, and we are keeping dealing with those Western force against the internationalism, against the working people. Recently, a couple of years ago, we commemorate the so-called operation, Operación Carlota. Operación Carlota is the name that we Cubans gave to the internationalism that our troops went to Angola and fight against the racism against the South Africa at that time, and contribute to the liberation of Angola and Namibia. So it's in the way that we can continue to honoring the October Revolution. That's why I ask you to continue giving support of us because we had to defeat the blockade against Cuba, and we had to talk about compensation because of the damages of the blockade that have been suffering my people. And we have to ask, to demand the return of the territory of the naval base in there, in Guantanamo. So many thanks.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Copy that, Houston. You're tuned in to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario, and around the world.
If you have a local business, event, or initiative that you would like to promote, CFRU can help you out. Free public service announcements are available to all not-for-profit events and organizations, while for-profits have the option to choose from an ad package that is competitively priced to give you the highest quality ad at the best deals available. A staff member will guide you through the entire process and ensure that you are pleased with the final result before it is put on air. If you are interested in having an ad or PSA run on our station, please contact outreach at cfru.ca for more information.
Yeah, well, you don't know this is Tasha T, and you don't know anytime I'm in Guelph, I always tune into Nikki Dread and the Crooked Beat. Oh, you mean, man? On CFRU 93.3 FM every Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m. You don't know. We're gonna rectify the problem. Let's live and learn to solve them. We're gonna make it work together for the children. Oh, you mean, man? 25 years of reggae revolution. Set it!
At ARCH, HIV/AIDS Resources and Community Health, we dream of a time and place where everyone is free to live healthy, stigma-free, vital lives. To achieve this vision, we provide programs, services, education, and support to people living with, affected by, and at risk of HIV and AIDS in Guelph, Wellington, Dufferin, Grey, and Bruce counties. In honor of the upcoming AIDS Awareness Week 2015, taking place between November 23rd and December 1st, ARCH presents Get Ready, Set, Knit, The Red Scarf Project, the AIDS Awareness Week Launch and Volunteer Open House, the film and discussion of the film It's Not Over, Update Your HIV STI Status, and World AIDS Day Vigil and Potluck. For more information and details about these events, check out archguelph.ca/events. On behalf of ARCH Guelph staff, volunteers, and the people served, we look forward to seeing you come out to honor and commemorate AIDS Awareness Week 2015.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I want to move on now. Like, we were talking about the Cuban Revolution, we were talking about the Haitian Revolution, and I actually want to talk a little bit about the Chinese Revolution, even though there really isn't, like, that much really anniversary to really mark today. Though, apparently, Brendan might have something to say otherwise. Because I am in the studio with Brendan Campisi here, and we are going to be talking about who has been... been here numerous times, and he has he keeps coming back. He's got great analysis, and so it's a pleasure having him on the show. And we're going to talk about Red Star Over China, which is a classic book by an American journalist, Edgar Snow, who was in China in the 1930s. and who was with Mao Zedong. He was really the first Western journalist to really interview Mao Zedong and travel with the Red Army and really experience what their struggle was about. But as an introduction to that, I really want to I want to quote Mao Zedong himself, the revolutionary leader of the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese Revolution. His article, "Serve the People," which came out on September 8th, 1944. And this speech was delivered by Mao Zedong at a memorial meeting for comrade Chiang Su-te, held by the departments directly under the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China. So he is commemorating a fallen comrade in the liberation struggle of China at this with this speech. And he says, "Our Communist Party and the 8th Route and new 4th Armies led by our party are battalions of the revolution. These battalions of ours are wholly dedicated to the liberation of the people and work entirely in the people's interests." Comrade Chiang Su-te was in the ranks of these battalions. "All men must die, but death can vary in its significance. The ancient Chinese writer Sun Quan said, 'Though death befalls all men alike, it may be weightier than Mount Tai or lighter than a feather.' To die for the people is weightier than Mount Tai, but to work for the fascists and die for the exploiters and oppressors is lighter than a feather. Comrade Chiang Su-te died for the people, and his death is indeed weightier than Mount Tai. If we have shortcomings, we are not afraid to have them pointed out and criticized, because we serve the people. Anyone, no matter who, may point out our shortcomings. If he is right, we will correct him. We will correct them. If what he proposes will benefit the people, we will act upon it. The idea of better troops and simpler administration was put forward by Mr. Lai Ting-ming, who is not a communist. He made a good suggestion, which is of the benefit of the people, and we have adopted it. If, in the interest of the people, we persist in doing what is right and correct what is wrong, our ranks will surely thrive. We hail from all corners of the country and have joined together for a common revolutionary objective. And we need the vast majority of the people with us on the road to this objective. Today, we already lead base areas with a population of 91 million. But this is not enough. To liberate the whole nation, more are needed. In times of difficulty, we must not lose sight of our achievements. We must see the bright future and must pluck up our courage. The Chinese people are suffering. It is our duty to save them. We must exert ourselves in struggle. Wherever there is struggle, there is sacrifice, and death is a common occurrence. But we have the interests of the people and the sufferings of the great majority at heart. And when we die for the people, it is a worthy death. Nevertheless, we should do our best to avoid unnecessary sacrifices. Our cadres must show concern for every soldier, and all people in the revolutionary ranks must care for each other, must love and help each other. From now on, when anyone in our ranks who has done some useful work dies, be he soldier or cook, we should have a funeral ceremony and a memorial meeting in his honor. This should become the rule, and it should be introduced among the people as well. When someone dies in a village, let a memorial meeting be held. In this way, we express our mourning for the dead and unite all the people." So that's what Mao Zedong said in "Serve the People." And so with that, I think that's a fitting introduction to what Brendan's going to say. So I'm gonna turn it over to him, and we're going to start to talk about Red Star Over China by Edgar Snow. So hello, Brendan, and welcome once again to Back in the USSR.
Always good to be here.
Mm-hmm. So I think we should start by just giving a little background, like, who is Edgar Snow, and how did he end up in China?
Sure. First, I just wanted to say, by way of anniversaries, I think there is a relevant anniversary because was Mao's birth. Mm-hmm. It was the anniversary of Mao's birth on December 26th, not too long ago.
Right. That's true.
But all right. So
that is significant.
Edgar Snow was born in Missouri in 1906, And he studied journalism for a little bit, but then he dropped out of university. And in the 1920s, he went to try to make his fortune in the stock market. And he had the world historic fortune to quit while he was ahead in 1928, before the stock market crashed in 1929. Right. And he decided to take his money and go travel the world a bit. And so he traveled and he started writing about his experiences. And he ended up in China. And in China, he started working as a journalist, first for an English language Chinese newspaper and then for the Saturday Evening Post back in the United States. And he lived in China, I believe, until 1941, during which time he went into, in the late 30s, he went into the communist-controlled area of China as, again, the first Western journalist to go there, as you mentioned, the first Western journalist to interview Mao Zedong. And then he went back to Beijing, where he was living, and during the war, he reported from the Asian Theater for various American newspapers. And he went back to the United States in the 1950s, but because of his perceived support for communism, and especially for communist China, he found it difficult to make a living from his writing, and he went to Switzerland in the 1950s. And he remained a strong supporter of the People's Republic of China. He went back in 1960. He met Mao again. He traveled throughout the country. He published more writing on China. And he returned again in 1970, where he actually helped to arrange the trip 2 years later of Richard Nixon to China. And during the week that he was in China, the week that Nixon was in China in 1972, Edgar Snow died, a bit sadly before seeing the full normalization of relations between China and the United States, which I think he would have found immensely gratifying to see, because he had been working for friendly relations between China and the United States for most of his life at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a pretty significant experience that he obviously had in China, had a major impact on his life.
Yes.
So how really did he come into contact with Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communists? Like, this is in the 30s.
Right.
When he first does this.
Yes.
But he'd been living there, like, you know, since the late 1920s.
Yeah. So at this point, the story here sort of begins in 1935, 36. So at this point, during and after the Long March, and the communist-controlled area of China is blockaded by the Kuomintang. It's very, very difficult to get there. But what's happening in the Kuomintang-controlled areas of China at this point is there's
Remember, of course, the Kuomintang, this is the right-wing, basically reactionary Chinese government that exists at the time.
Yeah.
Which only controls parts of the country.
Yes.
Right, and which is U.S.-allied.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So in the areas controlled by that government at this time, there's a growing popular mobilization on a nationalist or patriotic basis to pressure the government to fight Japan. Because
right.
throughout the 1930s, the Kuomintang had been giving away, essentially, huge swaths of Chinese territory to the Japanese because they weren't interested in fighting the Japanese. They wanted to fight the communists. So they were making concession after concession to Japan. And especially younger people were increasingly dissatisfied with this. And they wanted to fight the Japanese. And there was a large nationalist student movement developed, including in Beijing, where Edgar Snow lived with his wife. And he came into contact with the student movement, and in which communists in the underground were active. And so through them, he came into contact with communists, and he received an invitation in the form, somewhat romantically, in the form of a letter written in invisible ink from Mao to come and visit the communist-controlled area in the Northwest and to see what life was like there. So that's how the initial contact was made.
Mm. So maybe we could get into some of the backstory about the history of China up to this point, because, of course, you know, leading up to this, getting kind of the groundwork of the different players involved in China at this time, because obviously we're talking about the time of Japanese invasion. We're talking about a time when there's the political divide within China between the Kuomintang and the communists.
Sure.
And how that really came about. Because, of course, China did have a revolution in 1911 where it overthrew, where under Sun Yat-sen, the nationalist movement overthrows the last emperor of China. And then moves to try to unite the country. This does not They're not successful in this.
Right.
And ultimately, the nationalist movement splits apart, you know, and largely on the basis of the reactionary forces versus the communists. So maybe you could kind of flesh that out a little bit about the political struggles that have been going on in China before Edgar Snow
sure.
arrives.
And this is something that Snow actually does a pretty good job of presenting. And also, there's a great deal of biographical material in the book, including of Mao in his own words, but also sort of short biographies of many of the people that Snow met, including non-communist figures. And he does a good job of placing their lives in the context of these events that were transforming Chinese society in the 20th century. So as you mentioned, the year zero for all of this is 1911, when the decrepit Chinese monarchy was finally overthrown. And there was a brief period of optimism at this point that China would now become a united country, and a country that would be able to stand up to the imperialists, and a country that would be able to take its own destiny back into its own hands. Because, of course, in the 19th century, China had fragmented, the Chinese economy had been ruined by imperialism, and the masses of Chinese people sank into poverty, and there was mass opium addiction, and really deep misery for most of the Chinese people. And meanwhile, you have colonialism taking over most of the cities in coastal China. And this is essentially the state of affairs in most of China into the 1930s. So there was a glimmer of hope in the Republican Revolution in 1911, but the progressive forces at that point, led by Sun Yat-sen, were not strong enough to take over the entire country, to unite the country, and it fragmented. It began to fragment into basically a kind of warlordism, and there were attempts to restore the monarchy, but these ultimately failed. And there wouldn't be a substantial move toward political unification in China again until the 1920s. In the interim, of course, the First World War took place, and when Germany was defeated, Japan took over a number of what had formerly been German concessions, and Japan began to expand into China, and this provoked a mass nationalist mobilization, especially among youth, called the May 4th Movement in 1919. And that sort of crystallized a lot of the progressive forces in China and young generations of people who wanted to continue the struggle that had been opened up by the Republican Revolution in 1911. And many of them joined Sun Yat-sen's Kuomintang Party, which at that point had no real power. They'd essentially been forced out of any kind of position of power by the warlords. And also, out of the currents of the May 4th movement, you have the formation in 1921 of the Communist Party of China. And in the early 1920s, the Kuomintang, which was moving left and which was closely associated with the Soviet Union, Sun Yat-sen actually put forward the slogan "Learn from Russia." And there was a great deal of a sort of pro-Soviet sentiment in the Kuomintang. So the Kuomintang and the communists came together, and between 1924 and 1927, they were able to form a progressive government that actually took control over large areas of China, although not the entire country. It still remained fragmented. And this is what's known as the great in sort of the way people talked about it in the 30s as either the Great Revolution or the Nationalist Revolution. But the sort of warlord forces who'd been picking China apart for the previous decade managed to worm their way into the Kuomintang at this point. And just the year that the Great Revolution succeeded, it was reversed. And there was a bloody counter-revolution when the right wing of the Kuomintang and the warlords turned against the communists and the Kuomintang left and the workers' movement. And the left in urban China and eastern China was totally suppressed with great violence. The Communist Party was virtually destroyed. Tens of thousands of members were killed. And it was driven into the countryside. And it was at this point that they began to connect with the masses of the peasantry, because up until this point, in its first few years, the Communist Party in China was based in the industrial working class. And there are only a few figures sort of within the party arguing that the peasants could be a major force in the revolution, and Mao was one of them. And then over the course of the late 1920s, after the defeat, after the counter-revolution in 1927-28, they began armed struggle in the countryside. And they were able to build up an area of Soviet power in a particular region of sort of central eastern China, where the Kuomintang then proceeded to try to eliminate them in a series of offensives that all failed. But ultimately, the successful strategy was to, for the Kuomintang, was to blockade the Soviet area, which then precipitated the Long March, and sort of the base area of communism in China was sort of reestablished in the Northwest. And that is more or less the context that that Snow came into in 1936.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is... so... Really, what sort of people were in the communist movement in the 1930s? Because, of course, I know that that Snow goes into this in considerable detail, but the kind of people he encounters.
Right. So the very first impression that one gets about the kind of people who were involved in the communist movement, in the Communist Party, and especially in the Red Army, is of their overwhelming youth. The average age of a Red Army soldier in 1937 was 19, and the average age of an officer in the Red Army was 24. And Snow says there was a core, of course, of experienced communists, people who had been in the party for years, but they were constantly being replenished by a supply of working class and peasant youth who were flocking to join the Communist Party. And very early on in the book, there's an interesting sequence where he starts trying to talk to some of these teenage soldiers about their experiences and especially about why they had joined the Red Army. And again, the refrain is that they joined the Red Army because it was an army of the poor people and that they were from a poor peasant family or a working class family and they had suffered abuse and exploitation their whole lives. Their families had been subjected to the abuse of landowners or employers and bandits and the corrupt government and the tax collectors, and that as soon as this force appeared in their lives that said, you know, you don't have to live like this, you know, we can create a different kind of society, we can drive out these exploiters, that these young people, young men mostly, flocked to join them. So that's one group of people who were in the communist movement in China, is this endless and growing mass of young people from the popular masses who were eager to fight for the liberation of their families and their communities and their people. And also people who were motivated increasingly into the 1930s by nationalism, by the desire to liberate Chinese territory from Japan and to create an independent and united China. So there's the social angle and the national angle that were driving sort of these conscious youth into the movement. But there were a few other groups of people as well. There was, of course, a group leading the party, you know, the people around, people like Mao, people like Zhou Enlai, people like Deng Xiaoping, people like Lin Bao. And these were people who had been in many cases involved in reformist activity in late imperial China. These are people who've been born in the 1880s and 90s, and so they came of age in sort of decaying imperial China, and they became attracted to the various reformist currents that were seeking to solve the problems of that society. And they also eventually became exposed to sort of the new revolutionary theory that had been developed in Western society in the 19th century. They came into contact with anarchism, and especially after the October Revolution, with Marxism. And some of the earliest founding members of the Chinese Communist Party had been involved in reformist and liberal efforts in imperial China for decades, some of the older people, most of whom had died by the time Edgar Snow arrived. But they came upon communism in the aftermath of the October Revolution as sort of something that was a clear solution that finally appeared to them to the problems that they've been grappling with in the nature of Chinese society, a solution finally to the problems of underdevelopment and imperialism that was not simply copying Western society, but adopting sort of something that had developed out of Western society but was fundamentally in opposition to it insofar as Western society is capitalist society or imperialist society. And there were some people, in fact, who were older, who Snow did meet, who'd been involved in the Kuomintang government for a long time. There was one particular figure who was sort of the education minister of Soviet China. And he had been an educational reformer from the late imperial days. I believe he held a similar position in Sun Yat-sen's government. And he, for decades, had been striving to create a modern educational system in China. And he didn't opt for the communists until 1928. Because it became apparent to him at that point that the Kuomintang was and to people like him, that the Kuomintang was no longer a possible vehicle for their aspirations, these aspirations that they had been striving, that they'd been harboring for decades to create a modern and just and independent Chinese society. So you also have sort of the various progressive forces that have been developing in Chinese society from the late imperial period by the 1930s, all cohering around the pole of communism, which it seemed to them to finally be a way forward. And there's a third, I think a third interesting group of people who came into the communist movement, a last group of people that I'm going to talk about, which is basically bandits. The Chinese countryside has a long tradition of banditry, and Snow actually talks about bandits a great deal. But there are bandits and there are bandits. And in rural China, there were essentially two kinds of bandits. There were bandits who worked for the landowners and who collected people's taxes and who extorted peasants, you know, at gunpoint for the benefit of the local ruling classes. But there was also a long tradition in rural China of what Eric Hobsbawm called social banditry. That is, bandits who, you know, in the sort of kind of Robin Hood-esque way, they stole from the landlords, they helped protect the people from the tax collectors and from corrupt governments and from the army, and who, without any kind of clear political program, you know, did what they could to serve the people and to help the people. And there's also a long tradition of secret societies in China. And again, some of these were reactionary secret societies, but some of them were also progressive, and they played a role in the Republican Revolution, and they tried to fight the warlords. And from the late 1920s and into the 1930s, many of these social bandits began joining the Communist Party and joining the Red Army. And it often took a while to sort of incorporate them into those structures and to teach these forces, you know, a higher level of discipline than they had previously operated at. But I found it very, very interesting that the communists were able to tap into this pre-existing expression of the class struggle in rural Chinese society that had developed without, you know, conscious political organization, and to provide it with that.
Mm-hmm. Which definitely is significant.
Yeah.
You know, once again, tapping into traditions and in classes, there's something centuries old.
Yeah.
Right. And using them in a redirecting them and their efforts into like this kind of modern national liberation struggle.
Yeah.
Right. You know, that's definitely a very significant thing. Yeah. Because, of course, that kind of feeds into the next question, which really is the communist, you know, their relationship with the people and the kind of relationship they cultivated with the people and how they built a base kind of amongst the rural masses. Like, what kind of tactics and techniques did they actually go about in terms of employing that, like making that happen?
That's a very good question. That is something that is one of the strongest themes in the book and in you know, Snow's descriptions of his experiences in Soviet China, is this really, really close relationship between the communists and the Red Army and the masses of the people. There's one sort of vignette from very early on in the book where he meets a group of children living in a Soviet village, and he starts asking them about the communists, about the Red Army. And, you know, he asks them what a communist is, and they say a communist is somebody who helps the Red Army fight the Japanese and fight the white bandits and the landlords and the capitalists. And he asks these children, you know, what is a capitalist? And a child says, you know, a capitalist is someone who doesn't work but makes other people work for him. And he asks, you know, if there are any landlords or capitalists in this village. And the children say, no, they've all run away from the Red Army, from our Red Army.
Right.
So even at the level of, you know, children living in the Soviet territory, this political education, you know, pitched to them at their level, had reached them. And he describes sort of peasants in the Soviet zone being happier than people he'd seen anywhere else in China. And he says that people talked about our government, which he'd never heard anyone in China say before. So there was a sense of identification with Soviet power that existed. And the main way that this was created and solidified in the first place was by the way that the Red Army behaved towards the people, right? You know, there are these famous directives written by Mao telling, you know, Red Army soldiers that you can't steal anything from the people. You have to pay for anything you're going to take. You have to give back anything you're going to borrow. You have to be courteous. You have to help the people. And so at the level of sort of basic behavior, they were profoundly different from most armies in China, which carried out a great deal of looting and abuse towards ordinary people. And this was increasingly true of the white armies in China in the 1920s and 30s. So they gained support on that basis. But more importantly, when they took over a piece of territory,